Welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar,
the podcast where we mix a sometimes weird but always delicious cocktail of theology, philosophy, and spirituality.
Well, hello, friends, and welcome to another installment of A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar. As usual, we're excited to be with you today, and we're extremely excited about this episode today. We are interviewing a co-host of one of our favorites, if not our favorite other podcast, called The Bible for Normal People. If you haven't listened to it, you've been missing out. So go put that on your queue right now. And we are interviewing Jared Bias, a co-host and an author. And he just wrote a book called Love Matters More. It's a brilliant book, really beautiful, dropped yesterday. And we're excited to talk to him. But before we talk to him, it's always better to talk to somebody with beer or whiskey or something like that. Right, Kyle?
Always. Yes, absolutely.
So what's happening today?
Well, today we have a beer from Central Waters Brewing Company, which is kind of a staple in Wisconsin, very well known among beer aficionados in Wisconsin.
Is it known?
And a little bit outside of Wisconsin.
I was
going to
say, is it known outside of Wisconsin?
Yeah. So I'm in a lot of beer, like, maybe I shouldn't say this on the podcast. I don't know. I'm in a lot of beer trading groups.
Are those illegal or something?
Well, as long as it sticks to trading, I think it's okay. I'm in a lot of groups where people talk about beer. How about that? And Central Waters comes up from time to time. They do a few special release stouts every year. For example, they have one called Black Gold that everybody loves, a barrel-aged stout. They have an anniversary stout they release every year. And usually they have like a 5K to go along with the release of some of their beers, and like people flock up to Central Waters, and it's a whole thing in the fall. So it's a lot of fun. And they have this this series called Brewer's Reserve, which is just a series of barrel-aged beers of all varieties. So what we have here is called Call Me Old Fashioned. It's one of their Brewer Reserve beers, and this one is a 12% red ale, and it says it's got cherries, and it was aged in various barrels, brandy, bourbon, and orange curacao barrels. So there you go. Doesn't say what brandies or what bourbons.
Interesting. But. Well, cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
Cheers.
I'm going to say interesting.
Yeah.
My wife, Grace, really likes cherry Pepsi, and I feel like she would love this.
It's a little thin. I don't know, hot, like a young whiskey hot.
It's sweet, like barrel aged ales are. It's got that back of the tongue layer of sweetness. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not as effervescent, as bright.
Yeah,
as I would like either.
Yeah, almost tastes over carbonated to me.
Over carbonated.
That makes sense. Huh. Yeah,
it tastes like really high quality coffee syrup.
So, interesting. Yeah.
It's a good.
That's thing. A very nice backhanded compliment.
Yeah,
there, Elliot. That's good.
It's not really nice.
That's like the best version of the. This is like the best version of the cheap way to flavor your beverage.
Yeah.
I mean, Central Waters does some great stuff, but I'm just.
They really do. Yeah.
Is it? I wonder if it's
maybe not their best.
This might be a bit more of a novelty, though. Is it? It's something that's kind of. It's meant to be a bit off.
Yeah,
the path,
I think
right?
The idea is that it's supposed to taste like a. Like a brandy old fashioned, I think is the idea.
I feel like if we,
which I'm kind of opposed to the idea of a brandy old fashioned anyway. So maybe I'm not the target.
You can't
audience.
Say that in Wisconsin.
I mean, I like
I agree.
Rye. I like rye or bourbon old fashions, but old fashions are my jam. I feel like if we were at a real bar, the name in the brewery would have caught our attention. And we would have said, "Yeah, let's have some of that,"
mm-hmm.
and then we would have had this experience.
Yeah.
Yeah, don't let this put you off of their other Brewer's Reserve series, though, because they do have some interesting stuff.
I mean, God bless Central Waters, but for me, and we'll find this because I know you love barrel-aged stouts and all that business, Kyle, but if barrel-aged beers of all sorts just went away, I think the world would be a better place.
Oh, good grief. What is wrong with you? Oh, geez. I'm going to, just because of that, just for that comment, I'm going to force you to
go
drink
back
some
to our previous episode, disagreeing well.
Right.
Well, hopefully our interview is more tasteful than the beer, right?
You are just full of the backhanded. They're not even backhanded compliments. They're just.
Just insults.
Just insults. All right. Well, Central Waters, Nice try.
So on this episode, we're really excited to have our guest, Jared Bias. He is the co-host of one of our favorite podcasts. It's called The Bible for Normal People. I have to say, Jared, it's one of my favorite podcasts, being an academic, because I feel like you guys really showcase genuine expertise. And this is something that is fairly unusual in the kind of progressive evangelical podcast space that we both inhabit. So I'm super grateful for you guys for doing that. And you have a new book coming out, and we're really excited to talk with you about it on this episode.
Excellent. Well, thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
Awesome. Jared, you recently wrote Love Matters More. That's out now. People can get it everywhere you buy books. And it's a really, really wonderful book. I'm wondering why you wrote it. What inspired you to write that? What was the process as to why you think it's important?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes down to, and I think this theme will come up again and again, and I love that you guys bring a philosophical and a pastoral perspective, because for me, it was a little bit of a challenge to put those all within myself. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what it was, is philosophy, this pursuit of truth. I mean, I've always been extremely curious. And so that was, and also, if we're being honest, a need to be in control, and truth is easy to co-opt for control. So I was going down that path, but then as a pastor, man, I recognized really quickly, one, a lot of people weren't as interested in truth as I thought they should be, and two, that was okay for them, and in fact, they ended up loving and living well-lived lives better than me. Mm-hmm. And so it was this idea that, you know, in my tradition, we privileged truth, and somehow that was the magic bullet that was going to solve all of our problems and make us all happy, and love was going to come out of that, and it didn't. It didn't work for me. I felt trapped. And so this idea that love matters more is my kind of exploration through that, which didn't come naturally for me. I'm definitely more of a person in my head, more of a person who's drawn to philosophy and thinking and thoughts and being right and having the truth. So it was this journey of learning from other people how much love matters more.
Mm-hmm. Jared, you mentioned your tradition. What is your tradition? What's your background, faith, and maybe even faith and philosophy?
Yeah, so it kind of merged when I was in college, but I grew up in a small town in Texas. So I grew up Southern Baptist as well as charismatic. So my grandmother is a charismatic minister. My dad is a good old boy from Texas. So that kind of was merged throughout my upbringing, and then was drawn to a Presbyterian church in high school that I went to by myself because I was much more drawn to kind of intellectual ways of being in the faith. And that led me to Liberty University, where I went to undergrad, and I was planning to go and major in mathematics. So my major was math when I went there. And then I had this philosophy class, and I said, you can major in this? Like, you could just sit around and do this? Oh, I switched in a heartbeat.
Who was your professor there? Do you remember what class?
The professor would have been, Martin would have been my intro. He would have been Dr. Martin. I don't know his first name. But he's the one who really reeled me into this whole philosophy thing. And then I was like, oh, it's amazing. And of course, when you're in college, you don't think, okay, but what do you do with this when you graduate? Of course. With
start
a degree
podcasts,
in philosophy.
Obviously.
I was the only one in my class that wasn't like pre-law. Like everyone else that was philosophy majors they were going to like do something practical like go to law school.
And then you wound up in ministry. Mm-hmm. What tradition was that?
Yeah, so I would have went to Westminster Seminary, which is Presbyterian, not officially, I don't think, Presbyterian, but very Presbyterian. And basically what happened was in seminary, I had no intentions to be a pastor. I went to seminary, I wanted to get a PhD in presuppositional apologetics, which is why philosophy into apologetics, defending the faith, and really which is defending me and wanting to be right. And then I got there, and to be very frank, the faculty were kind of jerks, and I was like really turned off.
I think to be a successful presuppositional apologist, you need to be a jerk. It's been my experience anyway.
I mean, I don't know if causation and correlation, I don't know how that works, but so that's where that shifted. And then I fell in love with the Bible in terms of biblical studies and really getting into the nuts and bolts of how the Bible works. And that was really because the faculty really displayed the kind of faith that I wanted. And so through that, it kind of threw me off on my career path and led me to being a pastor for a number of years.
First of all, I'm blown away that Liberty University has philosophy courses.
They don't anymore. A department. A couple months ago, they shut down their department.
They released all the professors. Yeah, so there you go.
Jerry Falwell Jr.?
Yeah, I'm sure he had a hand in it, but that was
during his tenure. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Good. 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 So you studied along the lines of philosophy. You were a pastor for several years. Tell us how those two fields and those two vocations really have influenced the way you see the world, the way you see people, the way you see humanity, the way you see faith.
Yeah, kind of going back to what we said is that theme of I feel like they really shaped each other in healthy ways, where, you know, philosophy was even at Liberty of all places you could be to study philosophy, which is and it was housed in the School of Religion. But even there was a sense that we have to be open. We have to go wherever the logic and the reasoning and the evidence points us to. And so I really appreciated what I felt like was a pure, while the sciences did it with natural sciences, they did that with kind of hard evidence and other things. I found philosophy to do that with more about language and the human experience. And so that was really important to me because they were asking the deep questions. And that was something that I was always doing, even from a young age. I was very weird as a kid. I tried to hide it as best I could, but, you know, I was thinking about death and all these things from a very young age and trying to figure out how it all worked. And so that really was giving me a leg up in terms of what's the mechanics of the human experience? And then the ministry part of that was, again, a smack in the face to recognize, like, you may find that curious and you may think that's super important, but most people don't. And does that mean that you're right and you're better than them? Or does that mean we now have to learn how to serve other people and to help other people and to kind of walk with people on their journey? And so I had to, you know, I had to hurt a lot of people, to be honest, to find that out, and then kind of recognize that that didn't feel very good and it didn't seem consistent with the kind of life that I imagined for myself or for anyone. And so I had to really recalibrate that. And so the pastoral part of me very much was about learning about humanity. I tended to live in the clouds, and so it really brought me back to earth in really, really healthy ways, I think. That changed the trajectory of what I'm doing. So I don't think I do the Bible for normal people without a philosophy background and a ministry background.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you can hear it. So in your book, Love Matters More, you said, I love it when people do the research so that I don't have to, because I'm gonna steal this in the future. But you say Jesus asked 307 questions in the Gospels. Then he was asked 183 questions, but he only directly answers three of them. How does that inform your picture of God? What does that say about God in the Christian faith? What should that say about the Christian faith?
Well, I mean, I think it's open to interpretation, but for me, it points us to the fact that maybe we've put a little bit too much emphasis on the answers and not enough emphasis on the questions. And I think for me, if there's been a guiding principle for me over the last 5 years, it's the recognition that questions can be more powerful than answers because they're an invitation. And so questions really do meld the head and the heart for me, because the question is seeking, right? And whenever we're seeking, whenever we're curious, it's already and always a posture of humility, because it's always a posture of ignorance. And when I ask a question, I'm in the question saying, I don't know. And I think that's really valuable for our faith. So I think that it's important to recognize all these questions, and that Jesus was okay not answering directly. I feel like we have this, in kind of social media world, we think that just because someone asks us our opinion, we're obligated to give it. And even when people don't ask us our opinion, we're still obligated to give it.
That's my view of apologetics in general, by the way, giving your opinion when it's unasked for. That's so great to hear you say. Literally today, I was teaching Plato's Apology to my students and how ignorance, you know, admission of ignorance is the birth of philosophy. That's fantastic. Not many people connect it to what Jesus does in the Gospels, though.
Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite philosophers is Gilles Deleuze. And he talks about, you know, philosophy is the practice of happening not to know what everybody knows. And I really like that.
That's good. That's good. Yep, that's good. Early in the book, Jared, you talk about this thing called Umwelt. Am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I'm no German, but sounds good to me.
We're in Milwaukee. Everything's German here. So,
nice. Yeah, you would know better than me. You're the authority then.
Exactly. So Umwelt, I've never heard of that word, but I loved how you unpacked it and how you framed things up with that Umwelt. Can you explain that Umwelt, what that means and what that means scientifically, but also what that means for us as human beings?
Yeah, you know, I was looking for a picture because it's pretty clear to me in my head, because I've been dealing with these abstract things for so long, that we don't have access to absolute truth. But when you say that, it can be scary on the one hand, or it can be confusing because it's so abstract. Mm-hmm. But this idea of Umwelt I came across, which is just a way of saying, so there's the group of scientists called ethologists. They're studying animal behavior. So they're kind of animal behaviorists. And they came up with this idea of an Umwelt, which is the world as it's experienced by a particular organism. So it takes into account everybody's differences and limitations. And so whenever we think of a dolphin and their ability, how they hear things, and a bat through echolocation, and then maybe a bird and how they see things, and they can see from very far away. And that means that they're experiencing the world differently because their sensory organs are sensitive in different ways. So what one person might experience or one animal might experience is really loud, another might not hear at all because of the different frequencies and that sort of thing. And so they go through their whole life not realizing that there are these high-pitched sounds or that this sound is lower or higher or anything like that. So that, as they experience the world, is their Umwelt. And so it's not a very difficult step to go to humans and saying, well, we all have our own Umwelts. And in some ways we're more complicated because it's not just our sensory experiences, but because we're conscious and we have memories, we have this whole background. We have our cultures, we have societies, we have our physical locations, we have our bodies that are built differently. The conclusion is, you know, we all have our own Umwelt, and there's a difference between how we experience the world and the world as it really is. And so when we say we don't have access to absolute truth, all we're saying is that we have an Umwelt because of all of our particularities, and we can't get outside of those to see the world, quote, as it really is.
Yeah, it's so beautiful and would be so helpful for particularly Christians to come to grips with this reality. When you talked about the dolphin is one that came alive for me, and let's even think about because maybe somebody could argue, well, a dolphin jumps out of the water and they're really smart, you know, so they know there's another world out there. But like thinking about a snapper, for instance, who doesn't jump out of the water, just and there's this reality that their world is entirely underwater. That's what they know reality to be. It's nothing else besides that, not realizing that there's a whole world and then universe out there. That is striking, and that made me feel small and aware of my limited nature, which is really, really helpful. That brings awe and wonder and all sorts of healthy things in our process. Super important. Can you explain, like, what's your take on that a little bit? And Kyle, I'd be interested on yours as well. That just tells me maybe there are other worlds. Maybe multiverse is a thing, and we just have this tiny little understanding of what reality is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the whole force of that section of the book for me was we have to start with humility. And that's why I started that, the whole book with that idea, is we have to be humble about what we know and what we don't know. And, you know, I paint the picture too of scientific discoveries is a practice in this, that when we discover these things, they change our whole paradigm of what we thought the world was like and how it's made and how it works. And then we have to sort of adjust to this new reality and the things that we were so certain about that we would literally burn people at the stake over before now is incontrovertible. And who's to say that things in the future won't be that revelatory either? Do we think that we're so smart now that we've uncovered all there is to uncover? That's naive. And so it's this posture of humility that was the real force for me that I think is important.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So the main thesis of the book, I mean, it's right there in the title, Love Matters More, and the implication is more than truth, right? And so you say some rather provocative things in the book about truth, so I'd like to talk about some of those. One persistent theme throughout the book is this verse from Ephesians 4, where Paul says that you should speak the truth in love to other people, and you have quite a bit to say about that. So what do you think that phrase actually means, and what do you think about how it's typically used?
Well, yeah, and I think we could go on for this on this a long time. I think we have to start with the fact that this phrase really was one of the anchor points for me in writing the book, because this was a phrase that would have been utilized as a weapon in a lot of ways when I was younger. It was a get out of jail free card for I get to say whatever I want to you as long as I say, it's sort of like the just kidding of my kids, you know, as they can say whatever they want to each other as long as they can say, well, I was just kidding. It's like, well, your brother's over there like crying in the corner. I don't think it matters that you were just kidding. And I think that's how it was with telling the truth in love for people. It's like, what? I said I was telling the truth in love. Like, well, it doesn't look like that person feels loved. So I don't know what you mean by love, but I don't think you did what you thought you did. So I wanted to just unpack that phrase and say, you know, how can we look at it differently? How can we de-weaponize this? And it doesn't take us long to recognize, one, if we look at the context in which Paul is writing this, the irony for me of the whole thing is the whole section's about unity. And right before he says, tell the truth in love, he says, bear one another's burdens in love. So if we're not bearing one another's burdens in love, we're not telling each other the truth in love either. And I think that's a really important context. But then secondly, we assume when Paul says, tell the truth in love, we have so much baggage with that phrase. We have so much baggage with the word truth. We make all kinds of assumptions about what Paul means 2,000 years ago when he uses this word truth. We're post-Enlightenment, we're post-Renaissance, we're post-modern at this point. And so we just have so much history with this word. So what we usually think of it meaning is tell people my accurate opinions about how the world works. Like that's we're thinking that's what Paul means. But nowhere else, I can't say nowhere else, there are one, maybe two occasions of the dozens and dozens of uses of the word truth in the Bible where it means something even close to that. Almost always, it means don't be deceiving. It's an ethical and relational term. It is not an abstract epistemological category. And I think that's really important for how we understand what Paul is talking about. It's almost always in the Bible, truth is used in the context of relationship in an ethical way.
Yeah. That's really helpful to contextualize some of the other claims you make in the book, which from the perspective of a philosopher can seem a little bit startling, right? So you say things like, here's a paraphrase at least, that the highest form of truth is a life of love. At one point you say there's no distinction between truth and love. In another place you say, if you're not in love with the person standing in front of you, then you're not telling the truth, no matter what comes out of your mouth, right? So, you know, as a philosopher who uses truth in different ways in different contexts, that can seem a little bit shocking. Can you maybe contextualize some of those claims a little bit for us?
Yeah, well, I think it starts with, in the very beginning, recognizing, I have a whole chapter called Truth is Underpaid and Overworked. Mm-hmm. And that is, we just mean too much with the word. So that's confusing. So I try to break it down into these three, you know, Kyle, you'll probably maybe cringe at how I oversimplify this, but I thought it was helpful to have these three categories. And I talk about fact truths, so facts, meaning truths, and then wisdom truths. And so when we use the word truth, some people might mean facts, and some people might mean meaning, and some people might mean wisdom. And so it's important to distinguish those. First, so that we can actually have a conversation, because some people say, you know, is Jonah, the book of Jonah, true? Well, some people are going to say that and they mean, is it full of facts? Is it historically accurate retelling and accounting of history? Some people might say, is it meaningful? Is it telling us the truth about God and how God interacts with the world? And some people, you know, for me, there's an existential component to that, which is, am I living it out truthfully? Am I following its invitation or evocation? So I think that's important to set that stage, because when I say things like, you know, if you're not in love with the person, you can't tell the truth. It's in that existential sense in which Jesus says, you know, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Or in which John says, we have to walk in truth. Like that was a conundrum for me, right? How do we walk in truth? How do we use a verb with truth? Right. We walk truthfully. And so it compels us into this existential way of understanding that, so that I live out truth, I'm not just checking accurate beliefs off in my head, which is important. That's why the book's not called, you know, Love is the Only Thing That Matters, but Love Matters More. So this is, there's a place for facts. There's a place for meaning. And it's first getting clear and then maybe taking a look at our lives and saying, where have we placed the priorities in our own life and for what reason? What do we think we're going to get out of it by placing those priorities the way that we do?
And I think I, as a pastor, have a much easier time with the way you're using truth here, Jared, because of that biblical nuance that where I love this idea that if you're not walking in the way of agape love, you're just actually not walking in the way of truth. It's that simple. No matter what you believe, what you know, what you don't know, if you're not walking in agape love, it's not true, biblically speaking.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And biblically, I think that's true. And I would have to say, I'm showing my cards here. I wouldn't necessarily say this all the time, but you guys kind of, it seems like this is the appropriate place. I'm heavily influenced by the existential philosophers. I think they were undoing some of the bad habits of the philosophers that came before them. Like if we look at the pre-Socratics or even Plato and Socrates, they were highly invested in things like politics and how we run a city. And it was very practical. And then we get into the Enlightenment and it becomes this just, I mean, we're just out in the left field with ideas and it's good. It's good stuff. But it starts to get unmoored from reality, I think, in a way that the early philosophers would have maybe just not recognized.
I wish we could have a much longer conversation about that. That could be a whole episode, what you just said there. That's good. Before we leave this topic too much, though, so I would assume from listening to your podcast and now having read your book that you're very okay with the phenomenon that is sometimes known as speaking truth to power. Right. Which means saying some really hard things sometimes and doing so publicly to people who are in power, who are not interested in hearing those things. And then, you know, demanding change and sometimes even trying to forcibly start change. So does that count as loving in your view? And if so, can you explain how so?
Yeah, and that goes into, you know, there's a part in the book where I veer off because I thought it was important to talk about the freedom aspect of love. And again, if you ground that biblically, you know, Jesus' mission is to set the captives free. And so there's this liberating aspect to love that we can't ignore when we're talking about love. Love isn't just some abstract thing, and it's not just a feeling, but it's a concrete action toward, I think I use Bell Hooks' definition of the will to extend oneself for myself or someone else's spiritual growth. And sometimes that's a liberating act. And I think that's really important when we're talking about truth to power. And so I think we can't get, you know, that is a nuance that I think is a challenge for people is how can I stand up for myself and how can I stand up for other people and still be loving?
Yeah.
And I think that's important. I don't think the speaking truth to power is the problem. I think it's the way in which we speak truth to power that we have to be careful. You know, as Nietzsche says that as we stare into the abyss doesn't stare back into us. And that's the real challenge, is that we don't fight fire with fire and that we don't fight hate with hate. And I think that's the real challenge. We don't slip in self-deceptively the justification for our own hate in the service of liberation.
Yeah. One more challenging question while we're on that topic. Do you think that it's ever appropriate or responsible or best or something like that to choose who you love? So in the sense of to choose who to prioritize. So when I'm speaking truth to power, I'd like to think I'm loving those in power, but I'm prioritizing those who aren't.
Right, right. Yes. Well, and it's also the belief, you know, I appreciate some of my more radical activist friends who would say, do we actually think that liberating, when we are liberating the oppressed, we may also be liberating the oppressor? That in the end, it might be best for all of us to have a different system. And that, for me, resonates with Paul's idea that, hey, our enemies aren't actually flesh and blood, but they're those principles and powers and principalities. It's the systems in place. And the people can be symptoms of that, but really what we're after is a change in the system. And so, yeah I think absolutely we can. And recognizing that those people who are the oppressors are themselves also in bondage.
And I want to highlight just what you just said there, Jared, for the listeners, because some people could hear that, what you just said, and say, oh, we actually don't have to fight against systemic injustice and racism because our battles are against the spiritual forces, which is not what you just said, right? But people would think that you just said the systems are actually the powers and principalities that Paul was talking about, systems of oppression, systems of injustice, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I would equate that. When we talk about systemic racism, I would put that squarely in the camp of what Paul is talking about as far as powers and principles and principalities.
So it seems like you would agree that insofar as we're advocating for change to those systems, we are simultaneously in a way loving even the oppressor, right? But they're not going to experience it as love, which is kind of a segue into my next question, right? Because at a couple places in the book, like chapter 3, chapter 5, you seem to suggest that love isn't love unless it's understood by the recipient to be love. So can you help us to understand what that means?
Yeah, well, I think this is where it starts to get really messy. And I think it's not either or. I don't think it's not love if someone doesn't experience it as love. I think it's extremely important that we consider the experiences and feelings of the other person in our judgment of whether it's loving or not. And I think that's been my case growing up. We just discounted it. As long as we didn't understand the difference between intention and impact. So just because I'm intending to love you, and you get offended and you're hurt and you don't experience that as loving, that's not my fault. I'm loving, you're just, it's the impact. And we have to recognize that love is bound up in this relational sense where it's not the lovee or the lover who get to define what love is. It's some messy middle in there, in between. It's found in the meaning of that interaction. And I go on to say in the book, meaning isn't determined by one person or the other. Meaning is always the clashing of two or the merging of horizons, as Gadamer might say. And that's where it gets really messy. It's like, was it 70% you? Do you get to determine meaning? Do I get to determine meaning? Like, how do we do that? And that's the challenge of relationship, is it's somewhere in that messy middle. Yeah.
And I feel like that process can be extended over time too, right? So you give a nice example in the book of someone that you were going to officiate their wedding, and then you had some misgivings about it going through. Do you want to maybe recount that story for the listeners? Because I found it particularly helpful here to understand.
Yeah, that was, I had someone who I was going to officiate their wedding, had to do premarital counseling, had some misgivings in there, felt like it was not a good relationship. He was the husband, the groom-to-be in this case was very controlling, and just a lot of red flags. And me, you know, being young and not really knowing how to handle that kind of situation, I waited a little too long. I mean, it was like 3 or 4 weeks before the wedding, and I just couldn't do it. So I had to call her, who was the person in my church, the parishioner, who considered me her pastor, and I had to say it, and she was not happy. And she thought I was abandoning her and all of these things. And it comes, you know, turns out a few years later that he was quite abusive, and her friends had to kind of usher her out in the middle of the night, and she had to get away from that. And we came back around and we reconciled, and she came to realize that I wanted the best for her. And we wouldn't have known that, you know, and it could have gone differently. And that's that messiness of if we're looking for what are the rules by which we love well, I think that's a contradiction. I think that's not going to happen.
And I want to say too, I think that loving condition is also on the end of the recipient, where, I mean, I'm sure all of us have had those really painful conversations. I mean, I've had painful conversations with family members who would mean everything to me, who basically sat me down to say, you're walking in the way of the enemy and you should not be a pastor. Long, excruciating. And it took years for me to process that, for me to work through that. But I knew the whole time that this family member really was trying to love me. Like, I knew that. And these family members, it was more than one. But and that helped, actually. It felt a little condescending at sometimes on my end, but it actually helped to keep in mind over and over again, this is this person's best way of loving me. And I would love to get them to a point where they see that differently, or they act differently. But I do think that is a really helpful thing on not just the deliverer, but the recipient of that kind of thing, right?
Well, yeah, and I want to be careful because I've had many people correct me on this, and I think it's important. because I tend to be the aggressor in these situations, I tend to only see these kinds of situations from that standpoint. Now, there are other people who are the recipients of that aggression, like you're talking about. And I think it's important that we don't prescribe for people what our remedy is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this really important concept here of boundaries, right? And so if you talk to any psychologist, they'll tell you how important boundaries are in these kind of relationships. And boundaries are different for every person. And I think that's the important part. So yes, I would say that would be wonderful if we can all come to a place where we can be battered and abused and people can tear us down and we don't take it on and we say, hey, that's their problem. They're trying the best they can. It's not affecting me. But everyone has to have that line in a different place. Everyone has a different capacity to take that kind of thing from someone else.
Yep.
And I wouldn't prescribe some people the most loving thing you can do for yourself, right? Remember to love your neighbor as yourself. And I love the idea of boundary is that space at which I can love both you and me simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's really important. Mm-hmm. And so there are times when the most loving thing I can do is in a kind and compassionate way say, I can't have this conversation with you anymore. Mm-hmm. It's too painful for me. And we aren't going to be able to talk about this. Let's talk about other things. That's fine. And if you can't respect that boundary, I can't be in your presence.
Yep.
And I think that can be the most loving thing that can be said.
It's really good. And let me also say, I've been on the receiving end of other stuff like that, and they weren't being loving. You can pretty easily tell they were just being dicks. And I, you know, that's easier to handle.
Well, and I think the last thing I'll say about this, I think it's really important, and I think it's just a small part of the book, and I wish I would have made it a bigger deal, is I think the difference is, tell me your opinion once, that's fine, but respect me as an adult to know that I heard you, and mm-hmm. if I don't act on it, that's my own choice. And I think we treat adults like kids, and that's where I think we start to weaponize telling the truth in love. Like, mm-hmm. if I tell you the ninth time that your life decisions are really bad and you're going to go to hell or whatever, then somehow you're going to change your mind. It's like, just respect my autonomy and understand that I disagree with you. I know where you stand. Thanks for telling me. You've warned me. You're off the hook. So now if I go to hell, it's not on you. And just let's be adults here. So I think there's some growth we could do in churches to just treat people like adults.
Yep. So my personal favorite chapter in the book was chapter 7. To me, this is worth the price of admission. You guys should buy the book just for chapter 7. And in that chapter, you illustrate how Jesus in particular, but also the New Testament authors, kind of creatively interpret the text of Scripture, you know, like legitimately change its meaning. And then you illustrate how our own culture has done the same thing and is kind of still doing the same with various issues like gender, sexism, racism, LGBTQ plus issues. You reference Gadamer in there, which I was really happy to see. So one quote, you say, I have experienced too many spirit-filled gay Christians to deny their baptism. I almost like stood up and clapped at that point. And so you argue in this chapter that the Holy Spirit is actually guiding us into these more progressive, egalitarian interpretation. So I absolutely agree with you. I've said many times to anybody that will listen that the LGBTQ issue in particular is going to look to us in 30 years the same way. It's going to look to people in 30 years the same way that racism looks to my generation now. Hopefully. That's my prediction anyway, which means people...
In the church even, you're saying.
In the church, yeah. People will remember that people used to use the Bible to oppose equality, but they won't understand why. And it will seem hateful to them. So I think that is just the trajectory of our culture. That's where we're headed. And I think the Holy Spirit's behind that. But I can hear a lot of other people saying, well, that's just capitulation to secular culture. So how do we distinguish, in your view, between what the Holy Spirit is doing and what's just giving in? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think that goes back to, you know, the thesis of the book is the ethic of love. And how we're going to frame what love is. If love is just what we think God says, then that's a scary and dangerous position. But if we have these other criteria, like liberation, do people feel free? Are we freeing people? Are we extending people's spiritual growth? Are we including rather than excluding? And we talk about some of this at the end of the book, kind of laying out some of these ideas of inclusion and love and that's what guides us. And so are we capitulating to the secular culture or not? I would say, well, are we loving people better or are we not? And if we are, then we're going down the right track. And if that's capitulating to the culture, oh, so be it.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask a follow-up question, Jared? Because I agree with you, by and large, but I have fundamentalist friends who, you know, in my head, who would basically say, well, Jared, Jesus tells us to pick up our cross and follow him, and self-denial is the way of Christ. And so that doesn't seem very freeing. It actually seems restricting in some ways, but that seems like what Jesus told us to do.
Yeah, I think Jesus told us to pick up our own cross, not lay one on someone else. So in that way, right, we choose that for ourselves. Again, it comes back to respecting other people's choices, and that is a way. But Jesus would say a way of denying yourself is a way to true freedom, right? That's the paradox that Jesus talks about. And I think that's been borne out by quote-unquote secular culture of, you know, psychologists and other who says, yeah, the more you think about others, the more you're generous, the more you're grateful, you find life. And that's important, but you don't find that when someone else puts that on you.
Mm-hmm. So would you say that it's important to get your definition of what love is from someplace bigger than just the text of the Bible?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think we have to. Yeah, I think we have to. We have to recognize that things, well, one, the text is the text. And nowhere in the Bible does it say, I think we do this already and we do it intuitively until we don't want to. And then we set up these barriers where it's fine to go outside the text for all kinds of things, except for the things that we don't want to go outside, except for the things that we actually don't want to believe. And then we just stick to the text, which feels disingenuous to me.
Yeah.
So explain that, you guys, because, I mean, even me, I'm like, oh, interesting. Kyle's glad that Jared said that. I don't know what I think about that. Tell us why you guys think that.
Do you want to go first, Kyle?
Sure, yeah. I mean, you can, this could be the subject of a whole other episode. You can make the Bible mean anything you want the Bible to mean. And you can, as Jared is pointing out, pick parts of it to focus on that that you can then enforce in your experience and in your communities, and then ignore other parts and not realize that you're ignoring those other parts. And when it comes to something as big and pervasive and important as defining what love is, basing it on your particular reading of this ancient text is going to be limited whether you realize that it's limited or not. And you're going to sort of step outside of your own methodology, even if you don't intend to. So something that, you know, you think you're getting your definition of love from the text, but then in some situation in your life, you're gonna act in a way that you assume is loving. But if you were to reflect on whether it matches your definition that you're getting from the text, you'd find that it doesn't. And so in practice, your definition is actually bigger than you think it is, even in practice. And it's just my view in general that humans ought not to just submit to epistemic authorities, whatever the authority, whether it's a text or, you know, a magisterium of experts who have pronounced on a text or whatever. Personal experience and reason and objective factors like health, those should influence your view of something as big as love. And if they conflict with your reading of the text, well, that's a problem for your reading of the text.
I would maybe just, I may be saying the same thing, but I think two things come to my mind. One is we do not live in ancient Palestine 2,000 years ago, so we're already bringing baggage to the text, and it's dangerous to think we're just getting it from the text. We can't. Like, what does that mean? So even though there's a word called agape, we don't know exactly how that was used in everyday language 2,000 years ago. We just don't. We don't have enough evidence for that. And so we're always importing our own experiences because that's what we have to do. We're human beings. It comes back to that Umwelt thing. But I think, secondly, the corollary to that is our definition of love changes. Mm-hmm. What is loving kind of objectively, well, as objective as you can get with something like love, changes throughout culture, right? So if we go back, I'm trying to think of a few examples off the top of my head. They're not going to be great. But if we go back to the Middle Ages, and my son comes down with some disease, the most loving thing I could do is probably like put leeches on him and bleed him out, right? So that's love, right? If we tried to do that today, would we consider that love? We would consider that abuse probably, right? Mm-hmm. the same with, you know, when I was a kid, it's little simple things. Like it was loving to, you know, let your kids indulge in. I was drinking probably Mountain Dew when I was like six, right? Because it was like, whatever, it's the 80s, man. So, but that today, like, would I consider that loving? I don't think that probably would be the loving. And even things like divorce, to go even more, I think more importantly, something like divorce can actually be where in the ancient world, not allowing divorce was actually a way to protect women, because if you don't have a husband, you're basically relegated to being a prostitute. That's really all you can do. You can't go get a job. You're not having a career as, you know, a librarian or a doctor or an attorney if you get a divorce. And so not to get a divorce is actually loving toward the woman. Well, that sticking to what the Bible says has actually led to unloving things towards women in the 20th and 21st century. So if we don't evolve in our definitions of love, we may actually end up harming people more than we're actually loving them, because the context changes. Women aren't in that place anymore.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think Gadamer is actually quite helpful here. So in his enormous work, Truth and Method, he talks about how, and we could think of this in terms of the Bible as well, right? So getting at what the authors intended to say, right? The original intended meaning of the text, what the original audience would have understood, something like that. We have a method for getting to that. It's called the historical critical method. And we like to think as good evangelicals that if we could unearth that with our method, if we could apply our method appropriately, then we have the meaning, right? And we have this objective thing. But Gadamer points out that we forget that even the method is laden with cultural value. The method is a choice, and the use of the method is a choice. And it's a choice that culture could never have envisioned, right? They didn't have that method, and they wouldn't have seen the reasonableness in that method. And we do, because our culture has values that say that method is important, uncovering objective fact, whatever. These are just competing values. There's no getting outside of, you know, what you would call the Umwelt or whatever. And so he likens interpretation to a play. It's more like art. So you can have the same text of Shakespeare or something that's acted out by different troops of actors. And in one case, it's done really well and people consider it art and all the critics rave about it. And in another case, it's done really poorly, but it's the same words, right? And what makes the difference between the proficient performance and the shitty performance is cultural values and the opinions of experts at the time. And there's nothing beneath that. And that's a scary place for an evangelical to be, right? We're stuck in the boat, so to speak, as Quine put it. Like, there's no getting outside and latching on to objective reality. We're just here in it.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC, and if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's StoryhillBKC.com.
So towards, I don't know, the two-thirds of the way through the book or so, you say this. So here's a quote. You say, as long as we use love, and I think you mean in interpreting the Bible, that's what you're talking about in the context here. So as long as we use love in interpreting the Bible, we need not worry about not having enough degrees to read it accurately. So this kind of connects up to what we were just talking about. So you're the host of a podcast whose explicit stated goal is listening to people with degrees talk about how to read the Bible accurately, or at least well, right? Mm-hmm. Can you frame that up for us? What do you mean by that? And you use an example that I found super helpful. So maybe if you want to just retell the example, you use the analogy of jazz improvisation.
Yeah, it kind of does go back to that. And I think that's more of the jazz analogy in improvisation is more about methodology. But before that, I would, again, I'm trying to again and again unearth this presupposition that would have been in my tradition, which is the best Christians are the smartest Christians. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a fallacy. That's really what I'm after here. And so this idea that you have to have all these degrees, and you know what? Well, I know Greek and Hebrew, and so I get to be the one who's in the pulpit, and I get to be the one who makes all the decisions for the congregation and all of that. That seems fallacious, and I think it's dangerous. It gets us into trouble. So that's kind of the reasoning behind, hey, you know what? What I learned was I'll take someone who knows how to love well over the scholar any day as the pastor of my church. And I think that's really important. Because I don't know a lot of people who go astray by loving well, but I know a lot of people who go astray by knowing things, and I'll put that in air quotes. Yeah. So that's really the impetus for that. And again, there's a reason this is called Love Matters More and not only Love Matters, is I have utmost respect for that. Like you said, that's the first half of the equation. How do we respect other human? And I would call authorial intention a facet of love, because it's a way to respect the authors of these texts. We don't want to disrespect them by putting our own words and our own thoughts into what they intended. However, I also don't want to respect me as a reader saying that my own experiences and my thoughts don't count at all. And I have to shut myself off, and I only get to listen to what Paul said in the first century. I think meaning, the beautiful thing about meaning is it's a mutually respectful relationship, where we have to understand what Paul meant without bringing my own baggage into it, which is a little bit of my critique of progressives. I think they sort of read into Paul because they want Paul to mean something Paul doesn't mean, where I say, why do we do that? We just let Paul be Paul, respect Paul on Paul's terms, recognize that the Spirit of God is found in the intersection of what Paul originally meant and what we need it to mean now in our current context. And that's the respectful relationship. So Charlie Parker was I think it's funny that he probably didn't actually say this, but I put it in the book anyway. It kind of goes to my point. But he was rumored to have said, how are you such a good jazz musician or something like that? And he says, well, you master the music. The kind of the art of improv is you master the music, you master the instrument, then you forget all that shit and you just play. Right? So that's the heart of improv. And I think that's how I think of the people that I think weave biblical scholarship and this loving, guided way of life are those who love the text so much that they live it and they breathe it, and it's such a part of who they are. And I think of not that this is a great example, but I always think of Tevye from Fiddler on the Roof, who is just quoting the Bible all the time, misquoting it, doesn't matter, takes it out of context, uses it for his own good, uses it for the good of others. It's just always coming out of his mouth. And a lot of the Jewish professors that we have had on the Bible for Normal People do this so well, where you can just tell, I think I make the joke in the book, that they dream in Bible. Like, they know it so well that they're dreaming in Bible. And I think that's what that does then is it seeps into who we are, and then we can forget about it and we can play when we know it that well. So I feel like a lot of pastors, not to pick on pastors, I feel like they know just enough to be really awkward and really hold it with an iron fist. Like, there's another level beyond that of play and of creativity, but we have to know it well enough. It has to be kind of seeped into our bones before we can get to that place.
Mm-hmm. And you've been mentioning the Apostle Paul quite a bit, Jared, but I would say if we had a little bit more of a Johannine perspective, we might actually stomach this a lot better, because I was just preaching 1 John 4 on this past Sunday, and I made the statement that 1 John 4, if that wasn't canonized as scripture already, most evangelicals would throw that out as utter heresy. To say that we've never seen love, or we've never seen God, but if we love, God lives in us. There's no asterisk there. There's nothing. It just, that's what he says. That sounds pretty similar with what you're trying to get across with this book.
Yeah, absolutely. I lean a lot on John. I think that's exactly right. I think he definitely has more of that bent. And the reason I pick on Paul is because Paul gets weaponized in a way that I think John needs to correct some of that.
At the end of the book, I think it's the last chapter, you talk about hypocrisy, and you come down pretty hard on it. So what is hypocrisy, and how does it relate to truth and love?
Yeah, I think it's because I think the greatest danger of privileging truth-telling over love is that it ends in this insidious reversal. Because biblically, truth is used to talk about being honest with one another. And hypocrisy is a deep dishonesty. It's a deep dishonesty about who we are and how we are in the world. It's sort of an existential dishonesty. It's not telling truths. It's not telling lies. It's being lies. And so in the same way that true love is the highest form of truth-telling, hypocrisy is the highest form of deceit. And I think that Jesus makes that pretty clear. Jesus is quite opposed to the hypocrites as well. And if we think about all of the harsh words that Jesus has in the New Testament, don't quote me on this one, I haven't looked it up, but I'm pretty sure all of them are reserved for pastors. All of them are reserved for the religious leaders. Mm-hmm. All harsh words. And I think hypocrisy is at the root of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Jared, I know this is a baby for you, this book, and a labor of love. I have no idea how long ago you wrote it, but I'd be interested to know what might be next from Jared Bias. What are you dreaming and thinking about? What might you write next?
Yeah, well, if you don't tell anyone, so this book that's been brewing was me trying to take down the idea of absolute truth and how I think it's an idol. The next one, I'd really like to do that with purpose. Hmm. So that's really what I'm trying to, that's next on the agenda, and I'm hoping to get started on it pretty soon, to move from discovering our purpose to creating our meaning and grounding that in the Bible as well.
Yeah. We totally won't tell anyone at all. Complete secret.
Well, Jared, so grateful for you and making time for us. Really grateful for this conversation. It's been a delight. And I'm wondering, could you speak a blessing over our listeners, that they would walk in the way of love?
Yeah, and I'd like to, maybe for this time, I'm going to read a little bit of Kierkegaard's writings, because again, for me, where this all comes from is the belief that God is love. And that's sort of what grounds all of this. So I want to read this passage. I just think he puts it so beautifully. "This is all I have known for certain, that God is love. Even if I have been mistaken on this or that point, God is nevertheless love. If I have made a mistake, it will be plain enough, so I repent, and God is love. He is love, not he was love, nor he will be love. Oh no, even that future was too slow for me. He is love. Oh, how wonderful. Sometimes, perhaps, my repentance does not come at once, and so there is a future, but God keeps no person waiting. He is love. Like spring water, which keeps the same temperature, summer and winter, so is God's love. His love is a spring that never runs dry."
Let that wash over you today. Jared Bias, thank you so much.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoyed this conversation. You can find us on social media, like and share, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you're inclined to leave a review, we read through all of those and we love the feedback. Till next time, this has been A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar.